KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, UNC's Center for Information Technology and Public Life, and the University of Milan's Information Society Law Center. We have some repeat guests here on Hearsay Culture, and I'm very delighted to have back on the show Duke Professor David Schanzer, who has written a fantastic and nuanced, and I think very important piece in his Substack newsletter, Perilous Times, dated August 7th, titled, Israel's Gaza War Has Made Me Ashamed to Be a Jewish Zionist. Hearsay Culture focuses on technology, on communications, on the information ecosystem, and on social media. And we don't cover much the Israel-Palestinian conflict or even world affairs at that level. But David's piece and the way that David analyzes world events as an expert in national security and counterterrorism, I think is very unique, particularly in the information ecosystem. The Israel-Palestinian conflict, which has been going on for decades and, of course, was exacerbated by the October 7th terrorist attacks by Hamas, and then the subsequent reaction to it by the Netanyahu government has created, as events often do, polls. People talk in very extreme positions from both sides, and often what's lost in the discussion is nuance, not to mention facts and evidence. When you're dealing with the national security interests of people and when you're dealing with national identity, it's very easy to reduce these issues into black and whites. And what I think David does in this piece that we're going to talk about in detail is not only a nuanced discussion of these issues and a very personal discussion with which I resonate as a Zionist, which is the inability almost to have the kind of pride in Israel's reactions and in the Israeli state, even based upon Netanyahu's and his government's response to it, in particularly in recent months. But beyond that is having an honest discussion where we agree and disagree, but where we can discuss polarizing and very personal events in a way that's professional and respectful, but also fact-based. And that's why I am a reader of David's Perilous Times Substack and why I recommend this piece. So we're going to get into these issues. We're going to get into speech issues. We're going to get into, of course, current events, and we're recording on August 21st, 2025, and events are changing on a daily basis. But I'm super excited and really very, very fortunate, I think, to have David on the show to discuss these issues today. By way of a very brief background, David is a lawyer, graduate of Harvard's JD program in 1989. He's also professor of the practice at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy. He teaches in public dialogue on counterterrorism strategy, counterterrorism law, and homeland security. He's the lead author of a trilogy, National Institute of Justice Studies on Terrorism Prevention. He was a staffer in the House of Representatives as well as in the Senate in the 1990s and 2000s. And also, I think, and as an educator, I think this is really important to note. In 2023, he was awarded the Richard Stubbing Memorial Teaching and Mentorship Award for outstanding contributions to graduate programs at Duke's Sanford Center for Public Policy. He's joining us via Zoom today. David, thank you for coming back on Hearsay Culture to discuss your really important work and the broader issues that it encompasses.
Well, thank you, Dave, for having me and all those kind words. And I'm really thrilled to have the privilege of talking to you and to all of your listeners. So, great.
Well, let's jump right in. You know, your piece, of course, has a title which caught my attention immediately, and I think would catch the attention of many people who focus on this issue. You talk about, right up front, before we get into substance, your first sentence is literally, this column has been gut-wrenching to write, months in the making as I've searched for the right words, which any author can resonate with, but certainly on something like this. Talk a bit more about the challenges of writing this piece on a personal level.
Sure. I mean, you know, since my earliest consciousness, I've loved Israel. I've visited there for five times. I was there as a teenager and and pulled weeds out of cotton fields and, really identified in a lot of ways with the formation of the state of Israel and its kibbutz culture and the whole notion of Zionism. I certainly have thought about and understood the plague of anti-Semitism that has been present for centuries and have affected the Jewish people, and feel like that Israel was a counter narrative to that in many ways, and a state that was created on principles of justice and fairness, and that I could identify with as in many ways an antidote, a counter story to the global long-standing centuries-long narrative of anti-Semitism and also I think Jewish victimization that has happened over the centuries. So I've always identified with Israel, but I've never felt like I shouldn't that I had to be fully supportive of everything Israel did. I don't pretend that it is a perfect state or it has acted perfectly in any stretch of the imagination. But for the most part, I've been able to, I try to evaluate Israel's actions in light of the circumstances in which it has existed, which has been extremely difficult and violent and challenging because of many the actors that have surrounded it and in international institutions as well. And I felt like for the first 50 years or 45 years of my life, I've been able to be continue to believe in Zionism and believe in the state of Israel, be critical of some of the things Israel does, but mainly to continue to defend it. And then I think what's happening now is, to my mind, just totally indefensible. And that's what kind of compelled me to try to write about why.
So, again, we're recording on August 21st, which is really important because this show will air on August 22nd on KZSU and post as a podcast at the end of August. And God knows anything could change in any moment. But where things stand now, right? Where, we're coming up on 2 years after the attacks of October 7th, which of course were, whether they should have been or not is debatable, but appeared to be really a surprise to Israel. Israel's security was not prepared for it. Of course, we had well over 1,000 people killed. And then the subsequent reaction to it, which started as we Israel need to destroy Hamas, which the world more or less endorsed, has become much broader than that. And I'm curious how you would frame the current August 21st state of affairs right now in terms of where Israel is and where the Palestinians are. Now, I recognize I could walk away from the microphone and come back in 45 minutes, particularly given your expertise. But to those who don't focus on it as closely, how would you describe the current state of affairs?
I will do that, but I want to take a short step back and
Sure.
get to that I think helps us understand where we are right now,
Sure.
which is, as you discussed in your opening, the polarization around the notion of the response to October 7th. And so if you look at one camp, they look at the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas, the assault, however you want to characterize it, totally heinous in every aspect. And they argue that Israel essentially has a right to take any action, no matter what the consequences, no matter what the impact on civilians, no matter what the morality, no matter what the violation of international law, it doesn't matter. That attack was so heinous that anything Israel does in response is morally justified. And then the other camp, people look at, the huge impact on the civilian population of Gaza and say that the entirety of Israel's actions have been wrong, immoral, a scourge on humanitarianism, but just the enormity. And they look at the reported 60,000 deaths and say the totality of everything Israel has done is wrong and immoral. And I believe that Israel had a right and really a duty to its citizens to respond to the October 7th attack in a way that, reconstituted Israeli security and was a proportionate, rational response. And that was going to involve, unfortunately, as all wars do, a very severe impact on the civilian population, and that impact was going to be compounded by Hamas's tactics, which were to hide within the civilian population, indeed to build infrastructure underneath large civilian apartments, even hospitals, educational facilities, and so on. So I think that was inevitable, and the laws of war, the principles of morality do tolerate some level of civilian casualties in even in a just war. But I don't subscribe to the idea that because of the immorality and the horrors, really, of the October 7th attack, that everything Israel does to Hamas is justified, no matter what the human impact. There are principles about the limits you can take in terms of what it takes to defend yourself. There are limits on war. That's what war is, a regulated activity. It is not all holds barred, anything goes. And I think Israel, has crossed that line many, many months ago and is now engaged in an unjust, illegal, immoral war. Because the impact that it has on the civilian population is so severe compared to what I would argue are very minimal Israeli security interests that are at stake at this time when Hamas has been so radically weakened and Israel is in a far superior posture to defend any conceivable level of attack on them by Hamas. So that's, I think, where, and that brings us to the point that we are right now, where Israel is continuing a war that every day is, really killing civilians, whether through direct hits, aerial strikes, the continued destruction of infrastructure and buildings, and the lockdown and the lack of food, water, medical supplies that Israel allows to get into the territory, which is affecting 2 million people. I mean, we have to keep that magnitude of that the size of this population and how much suffering is going on. And sure, some of these folks are aligned with Hamas or part of the Hamas infrastructure, but only a small percentage. The others are, innocent victims, women, children, young people, who are not fighters, who are not radicals, and so on. And they're innocent civilians in the purest definition of them. And Israel is creating, really has created, a hellscape, which I can no longer justify. And that is, war is being continued for the, and we can talk about these two things I talk about in my piece,
Right.
the idea that Hamas must be eliminated, and that this is all justified in order to get the hostages released. And that's what I argue in my piece, that neither of those justifications continued to be morally justified.
Help us understand, David, that broader moral argument that you critique from Israel, because when I think about this in a sense, and I'm putting this out there for your reaction. You think about, for example, the dropping of the atomic bomb, right, in Japan, or the two atomic bombs, I should say, right, to arguably save a million, and I'm using rough numbers here, right, but save a million American lives through an invasion to end a war. Or you think about other efforts that countries have made to permanently, and I'll put that in quotes, permanently stop, right, the threat. Now, the counter argument that I have read, right, doesn't use that parallel, but it uses something similar, which is that if Hamas is not completely destroyed, it will merely regrow and attack Israel later, and we Israel have to put this terrorist organization to rest once and for all. Are there parallels to the argument that the U.S. made to end World War II? Or is that argument made by many Israeli politicians, including the current prime minister, Bibi Netanyahu, have any merit?
I understand it, but I disagree with it. Let's put it that way. I understand the argument, but let's pull it apart a little bit. So when you were looking at World War II, we're looking at giant empires in Japan and a huge military operation by a nation state, Germany, that succeeded in rampaging through Europe and Asia, killing hundreds of thousands, gobbling up territory. And both of those entities were committed to world conquest. Okay. And I understand that Israel has had, and I think we always have to put ourselves in the feet of what it's like to be an Israeli citizen and have to live in this environment. And so having an organization like Hamas literally on your border, as if you were in New York City and they were in New Jersey, has been horrific. And has been a constant source of anxiety, fear, anger, and so on. But in the end, Hamas is not and has never been capable of taking over Israel. It has never been an existential threat to the Israelis' existence. Even with the level of the heinousness of October 7th, which was, 30 times the if you look at the Israeli population compared to the American population, the number of deaths that occurred, it's like having 30 9/11s. And that's how Israel, absorbed it. They're still just a terrorist organization. And the threat from terrorism, while horrific, can be managed and eliminated and brought to a manageable level, one that's tolerable for the state. And I think we have to keep in mind that the reason October 7th occurred was, of course, because of Hamas's heinousness, but also because Israel's got caught napping and was, had just was diverted from a whole series of other issues and didn't do the basic job that a state has to do of defending itself from a hostile enemy. And so Israel, had it had the proper troops, had it had the proper awareness, had it listened to its own intelligence, October 7th would have never happened. They could have used the forces of counterterrorism available to them to prevent October 7th. And Israel, given that October 7th has happened, Israel's never going to be caught napping like that again. So the idea that you have to totally eliminate every vestige of Hamas, and if it could be done without a severe humanitarian impact, I'm not a fan of Hamas. The world would be better off without it. And I am certainly in favor of a new government, that Hamas should be expelled from governing and it should be totally disarmed. So I'm in favor of that, but I'm not in favor of a war, to try to achieve those objectives through warfare that is having, this just totally out of proportion impact on so many, literally millions of people. I just think it is inconsistent with international law, with my personal morality, and frankly, my understanding of Judaism. And that's why that's why I'm against it.
We're chatting with David Chanzer of Duke University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network. David, as I said in my introduction, we see so little, in my view, and I'm not an expert on Israel, Palestine, although again, I am a Zionist and I pay attention to the news. But I do know something about national security. I work in areas involving trade secrecy and secrecy and so forth. And so I want to delve a little bit in that direction before we take a short break and then kind of talk about the context in which we have these discussions. I also see, at least in my mind, what's happening, in terms of Israel's reaction to Palestinians, in a lot of ways, I think dovetails, not in terms of obviously the lethality or the breadth or the existential threat, some of the reactions that we see in the Trump administration's, ways that it views conflicts is very black and white. And then I also see a parallel, many of them, between Netanyahu, both alleged and actual corruption, as well as his courting of the far right to obviously the Trump administration. In the case of Netanyahu, he has some very loud and outspoken, and I don't think I'm going on a limb by saying not only far right, but racist advisors who have said things publicly like the Palestinian population should be moved to Africa, and of course supporting the settler movement, which has been violent, as of right now, in attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. Broadly speaking, my question is, we see the rise of the far right throughout the globe. The Trump administration is not engaged, obviously, in the kinds of reactions, because we haven't had that kind of attack recently in the United States that Israel is. But the far right seems to be ascending in lots of places. Not everywhere. There have been some examples of going the other direction. But can we understand what's happening in Israel, and even to some degree what's happening in the U.S., but I want to focus on Israel-Palestine, as an ascendancy of the far right, conflating with the, concerns that we've discussed already with regard to Israel?
Yeah, well, it certainly is. Israel's population has moved to the right over the last 20, 25 years. Part of that was when the fall of the Soviet Union, and you had large numbers of Russian immigrants came who had a different kind of perspective on the world than the original settlers who came. And Israel was really kind of almost a quasi-socialist country in its early years. So, the politics of Israel, of course, has changed rapidly. And the question of, a lot of Israeli politics is driven by the question of what to do on the Palestinian question. And there have always been, expulsionists, people who believe that Israel, in the concept of greater Israel, that would go from the entirety of the property from the Jordan River all the way to through the Gaza Strip. Maybe they even believe there are other territories that should be part of greater Israel, and they cite sources in the Bible, and so they have been trying to. They have their own idea of the solution to the what is a existential problem for Israel, which is what do you do with the Palestinian population, which is 5 million and growing, directly on your borders. And their view has been that that top population cannot really be tolerated and have Israel exist in safety and security. So they have been looking for ideas, concepts to essentially try to eliminate their problem by eliminating the problem, which is by getting these Palestinians off of this territory and making them all part of a greater Israel. They are expulsionists in the end. They believe in a kind of both a messianic and a Jewish supremacy view of the world that that these individuals, these Arab Palestinians, don't have any rights. Their human rights don't have to be respected, and they're essentially trying to kill the notion of Palestinian nationalism. Now, I don't wake up every day and dreaming about a Palestinian state. That's not why I'm for a two-state solution. I'm for a two-state solution because I, believe that in light of the history, in light of the way Israel came into being, the Palestinians do have a right to territory and to have their, their identity recognized in at least some form of sovereignty. And we can get into why I believe that, but I think history kind of demands that, and I think again, morality, international law, human ethics all demand that. But those things, the people who are in, and you said they were advisors, but they're actually, very powerful ministers, Minister of Finance, and I think Minister of Domestic Affairs, that are, essentially expulsionists. Don't care about any of these issues that we're talking about the humanity. They don't really even recognize the humanity of any of the Palestinian people. They just see them as a impediment to their view of what is, biblically justified as a greater Israel. And so they will adopt any policy, no matter what its impact, no matter what its immorality, that they believe moves them closer to this expulsionist, Jewish supremacist, a new reality. And, they may well succeed, but if they do, there's not much of modern Israel that would be of attraction to me.
Well, and before I take our break, that really gets to the heart of it. I mean, again, the title of your piece, which again, I recommend all of my listeners in your Perilous Times Substack, right, is titled "Israel's Gaza War Has Made Me Ashamed to Be a Jewish Zionist," which implies, of course, that you still consider yourself a Zionist. But the question I have really is, on this current path, how much longer can you be one?
Right. Well, again, I'm never going to kind of sacrifice or not believe that the Jewish people, historically were entitled to a homeland. I'll always hold on to that belief, and that would, I guess, make me a Zionist. The question is whether I could be a supporter of modern Israel. Do I think the state of Israel could continue to be a manifestation, a proper manifestation of Zionism, and a Israel that, was willing to ignore all aspects of human rights and Jewish morality in order to, adopt this concept of this greater Israel, is really just a state that would exist as a safe haven, for Jews. Again, I don't even know if a Jew like me, a Reform Jew, would even be welcome ultimately in a state like that. It would be a pariah state among nations. Maybe they would ally with Russia and China, and if we continue to have right-wing American government, but they would be divorced from the Arab world, Africa, Europe, and so on. And so a pariah state that had no respect or operationalizing any sort of civil rights or human rights or equality for among religion, among genders. It just would have no real attraction to me. So I wouldn't consider that kind of Israel as really being a manifestation of, what I see as the virtues of Zionism.
I certainly, I don't report on anecdata or, use anecdotes as a basis to form conclusions, but I certainly sense that it's certainly in my lifetime. I'm in my early 30s, 50s, 30s. Wow. No, I'm not in my early 30s anymore. Maybe that was a wishful thought, early 50s. I certainly have never, experienced personally or had conversations as I do now with so many people who are having the same, who consider themselves Zionists, and are having the same question of why am I supporting this current state and this current government. And I think that's a conversation that needs to be had, which is again, why I'm delighted to have you on the show. You are listening to KZSU FM Stamford. David, I want to talk about some related issues that help explain the context and how we might understand these issues. And I want to talk about, and I started alluding to it, I want to delve in more deeply, the information ecosystem. It's very, very hard as a general matter to get accurate information in a war zone. That's just 101. And in your footnotes, in the only footnote in the piece, you point out something which often comes up when talking about the number of Palestinian deaths that have occurred. And the Gaza Ministry of Health is often cited, which, as you point out in the footnote, many observers, quoting you, allege is an unreliable data source because it is run by Hamas. There's obviously no question that tens of thousands of Palestinians have died. And at some level, you might say, any unjustified death from a moral perspective is morally unjustified. And so, why are we having that discussion? But I think the real issue, and that's one example of it, but there are many of them, is how we get good information in places like Gaza. Now, I want to engraft upon that the fact that Israel has killed journalists. Israel has alleged, for example, with the recent killing of five Al Jazeera affiliated journalists, that they might have connections to Hamas or so forth. But again, we're talking about journalists. We're talking about people that are reporting facts. So twofold question here. All right. Question number one is, how do you get good information, accurate information out of a war zone, which is always a national security and counterintelligence issue? And then secondly, how do journalists play a positive role here, particularly where they might be alleged, based upon evidence or not, right, as being connected to one of the combatants?
And again, I'll step away for a half hour.
So go ahead. Yeah.
I'm neither a journalist nor anyone who's ever spent time in a war zone. Yep. So I don't think I have a deep level of expertise.
Well, I'm asking, let me be fair with the question, just to jump in particularly for listeners, right? I'm asking you from your standpoint as someone who studies national security and who therefore has to get good data. So I should be fair with that question, right? You're fair point, right? You're not a journalist, but you need good info. And obviously, I'm confident that you wouldn't write any piece, right, as any good journalist or commentator or expert would, based upon information that you consider to be reliable.
Well, listen, I don't think the circumstance where you know that lots of facts coming out of a war zone are not reliable, I don't think that should, can preclude us from, trying to discuss the morality of a war. We have to do the best we can with the information that we have. And we also, I think, as again, I'm somewhat of a journalist. I would call myself more of a commentator, but I'm trying to present the truth to the people who are reading my pieces. We, of course, have to disclose. I think we have a duty to try to disclose to the reader and say, listen, I'm going to rely on these facts. Here's what people have said about their reliability, and then you decide, how much credibility you want to give to it. So, disclosure of this problem that you're talking about, I think, is the duty of the author, the commentator, and the journalist. I will say that, I did look into some academic studies as well that were looking at this question of the reliability because it's come up. And I think, responsible media outlets have been doing a good job by saying, listen, this is the estimate of this place. And some people have said that it might be overestimated because they're aligned with Hamas. And also they don't distinguish between civilians and fighters. So that 60,000 number. But Other, again, studies by credible organizations, articles in, journals like The Lancet, which are, highly credible journals, have also made a counterargument that they might be underinflated because we don't know how many people are trapped under the rubble. We don't know how many, non-direct combat deaths have been caused, because of the lack of medical care and the amount of suffering here. So we have to we do the numbers are important, and I'll bring this to the second point in my piece, which was the hostages. Somehow we have to make some sort of moral relative judgment about the levels of human suffering here. And of course, it goes without saying, you can't even describe what 2 years in captivity in the Hamas hellhole that these individuals are being kept in, mistreated, who knows what kinds of torture, abuse, rape, whatever that is occurring. It's undescribable, their level of suffering. But we have to understand there's probably only 20 of them alive. So we then need to try to understand the enormity of suffering that is being caused in an effort to try to find and free them. And to just ignore it and just to say, well, anything goes. I just don't think that that's defensible at all. There is no system of morality that says that anything goes to save 20 lives. So that's why I think you have no choice but to try to do your best to try to take what information is available and describe to the rest of the world the level of human suffering that's being caused by the continuation of this war on the other side, and then make some sort of relative judgment, because again, that's kind of what moral issues have to come down to. Now, again, given the suffering of the hostage attack, of the hostages, the illegitimacy of their seizure in the first place, the trauma that the hostage taking has really caused to, literally the millions of Israeli people, if there was an operation of some sort, designed to try to free the hostages, I would say the balance there would allow for a lot of civilian casualties, moral judgments about civilian casualties would allow a lot of civilian casualties in order to free them. But this amount, I don't see that it's possible to justify.
Given the scale of the human suffering on both sides, but obviously at this point, exponentially more lives lost on the Palestinian side, it's understandable that people who don't pay a lot of attention to these issues more or less conclude, this is a terrible war and Israel's wrong and be done with it. And that I think we're seeing, obviously, at the international level, we're seeing countries who previously hadn't recognized the Palestinian state, like France, for example, recognize a Palestinian state. We're also seeing, I think, we're seeing members of Congress like Richie Torres, who's considered to be ardently pro-Israel, make comments suggesting that maybe that's wavering. And so there's a concern among those that support Israel that there are cracks in this kind of, uniform support. I don't necessarily think that support has been uniform at all. And I think that there's been more nuance there, but in public discourse, it's lacking. And I want to come back to that point that I made at the beginning, which is how we actually can have nuance. I don't mean nuance as in balance, right? Because the word balance is overused, and there doesn't need to always be balance. There can be right and wrong. You're making a moral argument. I have moral opinions, but nuanced and accurate discussion. in a polarized environment is particularly difficult. And the context I want to discuss that in, of course, is that we are both professors, right? You're on the Duke campus. I'm on the Elon campus, but we have family and others and colleagues in all other places. How do we, as educators, encourage our students to have the kinds of discussion that I'm trying to emulate here that I think your piece reflects, whether one agrees with your opinion or my opinion or not, in an environment that is so polarized, that's so quick to judge and label, not to mention, frankly, speak in juvenile name-calling ways that debase all discourse?
Yeah. No, thanks for that question. I actually don't find it to be particularly difficult. First of all, I reject the overall notion that's been perpetrated that all of higher education is essentially a liberal indoctrination factory, that no matter who you are, that faculty, all their goal is to do is to get students to believe and see the world the same way that they do. It's just been a political, essentially, lie that's been foisted and is now being used to justify some really draconian actions against higher ed. I don't deny that there are certainly pockets in universities and individual professors who do have that outlook and agenda and do use their position as a professorate to try to get students to see the world the way they do. And I think higher education has been negligent in policing some of that. Now, it's a very hard thing to do. We have academic freedom. But with academic freedom and rights, with all rights come responsibilities. And I think, academic institutions have a responsibility if they want to maintain the idea of academic freedom. They do have a responsibility to ensure that faculty members are at least presenting multiple arguments and multiple perspectives in their classroom, and that they're not using and distorting material, for a political purpose. So I think higher education has done a bad job in that, and kind of paying the price for it now. But in terms of what I try to do, and the second point I want to make is this idea of the student population, that they are all intolerant, that they've been, come into school with these radical ideas that then they're fed to them by, these professors in these pockets. First of all, in a lot of these pockets of these universities, there are no students actually taking these courses. We're talking about enrollments. The students are taking courses in econ and computer science and so on. So the idea that somehow they've become this ultra liberal, anti-Zionist group of the students have all done that because they're being indoctrinated by classes that hardly anybody is taking, a couple dozen students here and there. So that's just totally false. What I have found is that most students, especially on this issue, don't know very much, and they are thirsty for good knowledge. Mm-hmm. And once you give it, even if you give them an ounce of it, and again, I have started to teach about Israel-Palestine in some of my classes that are not, I don't teach a class on Israel-Palestine, but are tangentially related. So last year, I really started doing that for the first time in my other classes because I just felt a duty to do so. And the students are desperate for this kind of information and discussion. And once you give it to them, the comment I would hear most frequently is that, wow, there really are victims on both sides, And if that's your starting point, and then you can dig deeper. And I think that's a good place to start, because the polarized people, they want to make you believe that everything that the Palestinians have done and the violence against Israel, that they have no. And the other Palestinians, all they want to do is see Israel in an evil light from before it was even a nation state, and so on. And if you start there, you can't really, get into anything that's really meaningful. But the vast majority of students really want that, and that's what I try to give them.
Do you feel that therefore that college can, and you alluded to this, that universities, and look, particularly again, August 21st, 2025, right? Columbia, Penn have had to, settle allegations with the Trump administration. Of course, Duke is also, right, at least reportedly, on that list. I'm an alum of Cornell University. I mean, there's lots of schools, at least at the top level, that have, funds being held up for purposes of, and this is the question, right? Allegedly addressing campus anti-Semitism. Now, I read a recent piece on The Conversation by a professor at MSU that pointed out that at least in two of the settlements, there's very little about combating anti-Semitism, and there's about other issues there. But what is your critique of the campus environment? And I'm not asking you to speak for all campuses, but just as an academic at Duke, the campus environment regarding anti-Semitism, and while we're on the topic, right, anti-Muslim, right, bias. Where are things, particularly for those that are not on college campuses? I think this is a question that also flies out there, and doesn't have good answers. What's your take on this current state of those issues?
Yeah, just to clarify one thing, Duke has had reportedly had some research funds frozen, but it's due to allegations relating to DEI issues and bias against white students. Had nothing to do with
Oh, yeah,
anti-Semitism.
right. Fair enough. Yeah,
We
right.
had some protests at Duke, but we never had an encampment. And things of, there's certainly with tension and discussion and on campus, but it never reached the level of, let's say, like Columbia. So just that's just a point of
No, thank you.
clarification. But what's the mood on campus? I mean, first of all, I just want to say, I think this notion that you can make allegations, go directly to, then institute punishment, and then try to, extort funding from university to get to settle allegations that have never been proven and never been subject to any sort of scrutiny, is, I believe, is unconstitutional, illegal, and wrong. I'm very concerned, and I don't have a good answer to this idea of, I'm very concerned at ratifying this kind of governmental action. It is coercive in the most anti-democratic ways, and it can be used against anyone. Anybody thinks that, oh, well, that's just going to happen to Harvard. Well, just wait till you're a business and you haven't contributed to the Trump campaign. And then all of a sudden, you lose licenses that are necessary for you to, I mean, this is a step towards authoritarianism and it has to be resisted. On the other hand, I mean, the power that the federal government has over higher ed because of our dependency on the funding levels and visas for international students and permits to run various kinds of bio labs, or a whole series of the entire stream of student financial aid, all of which the government has its fingers on. I mean, if the government wants to destroy higher education, it can. It can get these institutions to either close down or be radically different than they are. You want to turn Harvard into Swarthmore, you could do it if you were
What,
the federal
just to
government.
be
So
clear,
I
what do you
really
mean by
sympathize.
that? Can you just describe what you mean, turn Harvard into Swarthmore, just for those that,
Well, I mean,
yeah.
you can so deprive it of funding for its research enterprise and for financial aid and so on that. Would we be able to survive based on alumni contributions and tuition as the only sources of revenue that we have? Yeah, but it would be a dramatically different entity. It would not be able to compete internationally with the great institutions of the world. It would not be able to, it wouldn't be producing the highest class of research, in all respect to the scholars at Swarthmore.
Thank you. That's why I asked her to
It
clarify.
would not be a place that actually, can influence the course of the future in the world in a way that Harvard University can. So I'm very sympathetic to the administrators who have to make these really tough choices, which is, allow this extortionist principle to happen in order to, preserve the survival of the institution in the way that, they think is important. So I don't have, I wish I had a great answer for that. But I don't.
Well, what? Yeah, I and I am asking is, I mean, again, it's in the broad context of how these discussions occur. I as a faculty member at Elon, I certainly have taken public positions aligned with yours, and also feel it very important that as a private university professor, and Elon is not a target either, like most schools aren't, that we stand with our colleagues at the universities who are, and I share your belief that who's next. As people who are involved in public discussion, I'm curious what you see as, or what you think the obligation is of professors, of people, and particularly people who have job security. I want to be clear about that. I mean, I'm tenured. I assume you are. I can, or maybe you're not. I don't know. But I'll assume, but I'm tenured. I can more or less say anything about the topics that we're discussing, and my job is secure. Obviously, there's limits to tenure. I'm concerned at the silence that I see from lots of people who have job security to speak on these issues. And it comes back to what we're talking about here with regard to Israel and Palestine, where people are afraid to speak up, either because they're going to be perceived as having a particular viewpoint, or they're going to be squelched, or they're going to be a target, or it's just easier to keep quiet.
First of all, just the fact that I don't have
Okay.
tenure. I've been on I get contracts,
Yep.
and I've been there for 20 years, so I do feel secure, and I have certain privileges that I feel confident that, if I lost my job, I would survive
Yep.
okay.
Yep.
So I don't feel any pressure to, mollify what I say in any way, shape, or form. And, I'd rather give up my job than have the job and feel like I couldn't
Yeah.
say what I think is important. I mean, as in terms of our obligations, I think we have an obligation, just to be truthful and to try to search for the truth. And that is the ultimate obligation of the professorate, and I believe that's the obligation that we have to our students to do in both our teaching and in our research. I am sure there is fear among many. For example, I talked to a tenured professor at Harvard. I was trying to get this person to come and speak to a group about the anti-Muslim task force that was formed and report, had a report by Harvard, because I had an event on the anti-Semitism task force, and we had a Zoom event about that, and I wanted to be balanced. And she basically said the environment didn't allow her to, she was, didn't want to make public statements on that issue. So this was a tenured faculty, at Harvard, who felt that level of intimidation. Now, this was about 3 or 4 months ago. Maybe things would be different now. And even though I feel like I have the privilege to speak my mind, and many of my colleagues have tenure and exercise their rights and their, to be very critical of things that Trump says or does, I don't feel any I don't have any confidence that it won't come to that, that we're not heading down a road where, if we allow this kind of capitulation, this culture of allowing governmental extortion, that, the idea that faculty can speak out and that the university won't pay a price when they do, that hasn't happened yet. It certainly happened to some students who are foreign students who are here on a student visa. So the government is using that level of compulsion to try to shape speech for people who are inside the United States. Whether this government would do that and try to punish a university for the things that their faculty say and do, I think that's certainly on the table for Stephen Miller and this administration. And we've lost. We're pretty far down the road towards autocracy once that happens.
David, let me last question. Biggest picture, right? I don't do crystal ball stuff. I'm not asking you to predict the future. I am asking you though, as it stands right now, August 21st, 2025, there are going back to your piece, there are proposals on the table to try to have a ceasefire, whether they happen or not. There's also Netanyahu's comment, as reported, that I'm paraphrasing, where he said that if we wanted to commit "quote unquote" genocide, we would have done it in an afternoon. That's a quote from Netanyahu. What do you see right now as the path forward, if there is one, to end this conflict and of course end the death, and to return to some degree of confidence that we have a moral place in the world for Zionism and for a Jewish state?
Well, let me take separate those two issues a little bit. First, this comment about Netanyahu, if we wanted to commit genocide, we would have done it very quickly. I haven't personally seen that quote, so I'm not vouching for it, and I'm not challenging you. I'm just saying I haven't heard that myself. I find trying to grapple with how to describe the enormity of the moral wrongs that Israel perpetrating, to be very challenging with respect to this issue of genocide. I don't consider myself very learned in the law of genocide or in the definition. Obviously, that's being litigated in the international court, and so on. I do feel like the idea that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians, the idea of the Palestinians, just doesn't equate, because we have Arab Palestinians who are citizens of Israel and vote in Israeli elections. So the notion that there's a mass genocide against Palestinian Arabs just doesn't meet the facts. I certainly believe there's crimes against humanity, war crimes that are taking place, mass human rights violations, immoral actions, violations of law, war of law. And I think that's a deep enough condemnation of Israel for me, and I'm going to leave it to others as to whether the international definition of genocide has been met or not.
And by the way, we have about half a minute, so sorry to cut you
Okay,
short.
on this question of the way forward, I'll try to make it
Yeah.
quick.
Yep.
I mean, Israel has a opportunity, has a possible pathway, which is to stop the war, align with the Arab states, get a new government, disarm Hamas. It can all be done under agreement. Get Hamas, get huge amounts of funding from the Gulf states to build a different society. But it's going to have to allow for some form of Palestinian sovereignty. If it doesn't, it's going to continue to move down this expulsionist path, which I think will lead to Israel becoming a pariah state, a state that has very little attraction, very little moral standing in the world. And that would be, a horrible thing for the Jewish people, for people who have loved the Israel and the concept of Zionism for their whole lives. But unfortunately, right now, it looks more like the second path is the one that Israel wants to follow rather than the first.
David Shanzer of Duke University, author of the Substack Perilous Times, which I subscribe to and I recommend to my listeners, and author of the piece Israel's Gaza War Has Made Me Ashamed to Be a Jewish Zionist, which you can also find on Substack. Thank you for joining us today on KZSU and the Hearsay Culture Network.
Thanks for having me as your guest. Loved it.